curved his torso away from the cut, the length of white metal flexed from the enormous tension, opening a bloody gash across Hilo's stomach with grisly slowness as the attacker's strength met and strained against his defenses. Hilo's eyes met the assassin's. He recognized him. Gom Obin, second fist to Gaunt Ash. Only narrowly did Hilo escape disembowelment. With a snarl of effort, he leapt backward, light, onto the top of a parked car. Gom released a powerful wave of deflection, and Hilo's feet were knocked out from under him as he landed. He slammed chest first onto the roof. His chin smacked metal, and his vision wavered. He heard Make Tar howling in pain and rage. The Duchess Prisa, with Ken at the wheel, barreled onto the street like a rhino. It clipped one of the motorcycles, sending it spinning, then plowed into Chandal. Gom barely leapt out of the way as the boy flipped over the silver grill and bounced off the hood of the car. Chan's steeled body shattered the windshield, then flew through the air onto the sidewalk as Ken slammed on the brakes. The elder Make burst from the driver's side, bellowing. Hilo rolled, hit the ground, and was up again. He lunged at Gom, but before he could reach him, the other mountain fighter, the one whose elbow he'd rended with the knife, careened into Hilo with a determined roar and dragged him down. As they both crashed to the asphalt, Hilo struggled, managing to wrap his arms around the man's torso. The green bone's aura spiked wild as he twisted in Hilo's grip, and Hilo took all of it, all the jade power he could gather, and with a sharp thrust of his palm, channeled into his opponent's heart. The assassin's steel buckled like balsa wood, and his heart spasmed and burst. The blowback of energy from the green bone's death rocked Hilo hard. With explosive force, the man's life lit out of the confines of his body. The resulting jade-amplified rush was worse than a physical battering against Hilo's skull. He reeled. For a second, he could barely breathe, and his mouth filled with a bitterly sharp metallic taste. Only because he knew what was happening was he able to keep his wits intact. He tore himself off the body before he could become addled. Talon knife still firmly clutched, he clambered to his feet and looked for the next man to kill. Instead, he saw that Yen Io lay dead on the road by the Make's hands. Gom and Chan, who'd somehow survived being thrown from the hood of the Duchess, had fled. Less than 2 minutes had passed from the start of the attack. Tar was leaning against the twisted grill of the car, bent over with a hand to his side. He'd taken bullets from the diverted gunshots meant for Hilo. His shirt was soaked with blood. Ken pulled his younger brother into the back seat of the car. Hilo could see him pressing on the wound with both hands, channeling his own energy into Tar. But he was no doctor and could only slow the bleeding, not stop it. Icy fury rose and spread like a white mist across Hilo's vision. It steadied his body and his voice as he pointed into the throng of frightened bystanders that pressed like packed fish into doorways and behind cars. "You," he said, picking out a new stand owner. "You, and you." He pointed at two others, a woman clutching her handbag to her chest, and the doorman of a club. "Come here." They turned pale and looked as if they wanted to run, but did not dare disobey the command in Hilo's voice. The doorman took several steps forward nervously, and the other two had no choice but to follow. Hilo looked at each of them in turn, making sure they knew who he was, knew that he had seen and remembered them, that he was speaking directly to them. "Spread the word up and down this street, and tell everyone you speak with to tell others." Hilo raised his voice so all nearby would hear. "Anyone who gives me the whereabouts of the two men who fled here tonight is a friend of No Peak and a friend of mine. Anyone who helps them or hides them is an enemy of mine and my clan." He pointed to one of the dead men in the street, then the other. This is what happens to my enemies. He set to work quickly. They needed to get Tar to a hospital right away, but a greenbone was entitled to the jade of slain foes and never left it behind for thieves. From the body of one man, he pulled three jade rings, a bracelet, and a circular pendant. From the other, he collected a belt, two eyebrow studs, and a jade-backed watch. He had to hack at flesh inelegantly to get the rings and studs. He gathered up the jade-hilted weapons that had fallen, two moon blades and a talon knife. Hilo ran back to the Duchess. He threw open the door and tossed the talon knives and moon blades onto the floor of the passenger side seat. Keys, he demanded. Ken fumbled in his pocket and passed them over. Hilo wiped the bloody fingerprints off the metal teeth with the sleeve of his shirt and started the engine. In the back, Tar gave a low moan. The car lurched forward, sending broken windshield glass across the dash. Hilo spun the wheel around and slammed on the gas. Chapter 19 Council of War. It was past midnight, and there was no one left in the Kaycon treasury, except for a couple of night security guards in the lobby, and two women janitors who moved from cubicle to cubicle in the records department, emptying trash bins and vacuuming the floors, chatting to each other in the lilting, long-voweled Abuké dialect, though they kept their voices down around Shay and did not disturb her at her work. The building had closed hours ago, and it was only because of her identity as a call and the letter in Shay's pocket, the one written in Lan's hand and bearing the clan's insignia, that she'd been allowed to remain at this spare desk for as long as she needed, which, for the last several days, had been late into the night. Shay put down her pen and calculator and leaned back, rubbing her eyes, which were sore from hours studying numbers underneath the unfriendly fluorescent lights. It occurred to her that she was nearly alone with the largest amount of jade stored in one place in the world. Several floors below, under immense layers of concrete, were lead-lined vaults of processed jade, cut into various sizes from single-gram gems to one-ton slabs. Considering that it housed in its bowels a stockpile that comprised a considerable portion of the nation's fortune, the Kaycon treasury was less heavily guarded than one might expect, not only because anyone who attempted to steal from it would be marked for certain death by every Greenbone clan, but because state-of-the-art security systems ensured that if any vault was breached, the intruder would be sealed inside. Unless the thieves possessed complete immunity, being locked in a vault full of jade meant a slow, agonizing descent into insanity before death. And yet, someone was indeed stealing from the Kaycon treasury. Shay had gone through the calculations multiple times, cross-referencing records from the mines, from the Kaycon Jade Alliance's official financial statements, and now from the treasury itself. She'd forgotten that she was good at this, doggedly following hunches and crumbs of information until they arranged themselves into a clear picture. Staring at the figures that covered pages of her notebook, even fatigue at this late hour did not blunt the astonishment and anger Shay felt as she saw with finality her suspicions borne out in cold, hard math. The mines were producing jade that was neither being officially accounted for by the Kaycon Jade Alliance, nor being taken in and stored in treasury vaults. There was jade missing from the national reserves. Despite the fact she had never intended to get involved in the clan's affairs, Shay was shaky with triumph and outrage as she packed up her findings and left the building. Her steps echoed down the empty halls as she took the stairs down to the ground floor and asked one of the security guards to let her out of the locked doors. The guard was a bored, middle-aged greenbone wearing the ceremonial flat green cap and distinctive sash that marked him as a member of the Hado Shield, a minor clan dedicated to the sole purpose of providing security for Prince Eowyn III and the royal family, as well as government buildings including Wisdom Hall and the Kaikon Treasury. Knowing that she would not be returning the following evening, Shay thanked the night guard as she left. She was not worried about the man tipping off anyone about her activities. The members of Hado Shield swore ironclad oaths of neutrality with respect to the other clans. They did not even hold votes in the Kaikon Jade Alliance. It was a short subway ride from the Monument District to North Sodo, but as the trains ran less frequently at this hour, it was 40 minutes later by the time Shay was walking the few blocks from the subway station to her apartment building. She was so engrossed in her thoughts, in what she would say to Lon in the morning, that she was only 100 meters from her home before she realized she was being followed. She was so stunned and mortified with herself that she simply stopped in her tracks and turned around. If she'd been wearing jade, she would have perceived the man behind her long ago. Even jadeless, if she'd been paying attention, she ought to have sensed his footsteps trailing hers. Shay dropped her bag unceremoniously to the sidewalk and drew the talon knife from the sheath strapped to the small of her back. It was not a jade-hilted knife like the one she'd carried for years, but it stored away. This was just a plain, everyday sort of street weapon, but of good quality and certainly lethal enough in trained hands. She'd been raised in a culture that deemed it unthinkable not to respond to a challenge. It did not occur to Shay that she could run less than 30 seconds to the safety of her apartment building. The man coming up behind her did not stop, nor did he rush at her. He kept pace, but took his hands out of his pockets and opened them to show that he meant no harm. In another instant, Shay saw it was Khan Yu, her neighbor. He nodded toward her respectfully, amiably, his eyes dropping to her weapon, and noting that she held it in a steady, practiced grip, her stance instinctive, coiled and evenly weighted across the soles of her feet. "You look like a greenbone," he said with a crooked smile. "You were following me," Shay said, defensive. "I live in the same building." "What are you doing coming back so late?" Khan looked incredulous. "I work in the evenings. What about you?" Shay's toes curled inside her shoes. Of course, it was none of her business what hours Khan kept. She'd been disappointed in herself and was taking it out on someone who didn't deserve her ire. She stowed her talon knife and picked up her fallen bag. "I apologize, that was rude of me. You caught me off guard. Shall we walk back then?" He nodded and walked alongside her, keeping some distance between them. "You seem very much on guard to me, Miss Shay. If I'd actually been a man with bad intentions, I wouldn't have wanted to face you with that talon knife." Shay wanted to change the subject. "So what do you do for work, Mr. Khan?" "I'm a security guard," he said. "It's nothing very dangerous. Rather boring, to be honest. I'm hoping I'll get a new job soon, something more interesting." He opened the door for her, and they climbed the stairs to their apartments on the third floor. He did not ask her a question in return, but when they reached Shay's apartment door, Khan paused and said, with a flash of teasing in his eyes, "Good night. From now on, I'll be sure to call out hello to you when I'm still well out of knife range." As Khan continued down the hall to his apartment, Shay sorely missed having the sense of perception that might have given her a hint as to what the man was thinking. Shay put Khan out of her mind, went to sleep, and called the Call House as soon as she awoke in the morning, when the sun was barely up yet. Doru answered the phone. "Shay, sir," he said, with false, mincing surprise. "Why haven't I seen you? I thought you would be at home more often." Shay grimaced. "I've been busy, Doru-chan. Getting settled. Lots of little things to take care of, you know." "You should have come to me," he said. "Why are you living in that place anyway? I could have gotten you somewhere nicer, much nicer.
I didn't want to trouble you.
The fact that he knew where she lived made her grimace stretch further. Hastily, she asked, Is Lon home?
Ah, said Doru.
A long pause followed, one that began to ring alarm bells in her head.
There's been trouble, I'm afraid. Perhaps you ought to come over.
Shay hailed a taxi to take her straight to the call home. It crawled infuriatingly slowly through morning traffic, fighting the crush of honking cars, motorcycles, and parcel-laden bicycles, all of which employed a survival-of-the-fittest approach to intersections and road sign compliance. The whole way there, Shay stared unseeing out the window. She felt sick at heart. Not because men had tried to kill her brother Hilo. That was hardly shocking to her. If anything, she was surprised it didn't happen more often. Yet no one had phoned to tell her. Not even Lon. Had she not called the house this morning, she would still be oblivious. Perhaps in all the commotion last night, it simply hadn't occurred to them to contact her. She'd been out of the country and out of touch for years. Perhaps she shouldn't be so upset that she hadn't been informed right away. She arrived to find her brothers in a council of war. Armed and severe-looking fists were everywhere, guarding the gate and the entrance to the house, prowling the property, and standing in the hallways. In the pillar's study, Lon and Hilo were smoking grimly and plotting. Doru was with them. When Shay walked in, their postures told her everything. Lon leaned against his desk, tapping ashes into a tray, his face stiff and drawn. Hilo was sitting forward on the edge of one armchair, elbows on knees, staring at nothing, cigarette dangling from the fingers of one hand. Doru rested back in the other chair, legs crossed, subtly apart, watching. The tension in the room was such that Shay's indignation failed her, driven out by an implacable sense of apprehension. Hilo raised his eyes when she came into the study. There were lines on his face that made him look like a different person, not his usual insouciant self. Shay noticed dried blood under his nails, and beneath a white shirt that she suspected was actually Lon's, gauze bandages encircled his midsection. Tara's in the hospital, he said, as if she'd been standing there the whole time. Shay was not even sure which one Tar was, whether he was the man she'd seen with Hilo in the hotel. Will he be all right? She asked, because that seemed to be the appropriate thing to say. He'll live. Wen is over there with him. Hilo got up and circled restlessly, like a dog unable to lie down. The door opened and Make Ken thrust his head into the room. He wasn't the one she'd seen at the hotel. That must have been Tar, then, the one now in the hospital.
Everyone's here, Ken said. We're ready to go. Lanza, Doru spoke up. I'll ask you again to reconsider. This could go badly for us. We can still negotiate a truce in the armpit.
No, Doru, Lon said, stubbing out his cigarette in the ashtray and walking to the door with Hilo.
Not anymore.
From the angle of the men's bodies, Shay understood. Doru was being nudged out. Lon no longer trusted him. The attempted murder of Hilo had pushed the pillar too far, sided him with his brother. Doru must have known it as well, because there was a deceptive impassiveness to his face, and he did not move from his spot in the chair as the other two men left. Shay followed her brothers. The foyer of the house was filled with Hilo's men, armed to the teeth with moonblades, talon knives, and pistols. As Hilo walked into their midst, they coalesced around him. He did not speak, but seemed, somehow, to acknowledge each of them with a held glance, a nod, a touch on the shoulder or arm. Shay went to Lon.
Where are you going?
To the factory. He shrugged on a leather vest and tightened it. Someone brought him his best moonblade, a 34-inch Da Tenori with a 22-inch tempered white carbon steel blade and 5 jade stones in the hilt. He strapped it to his waist. It had been some time since Shay had seen him look so military, so much like their father, that the effect was disorienting. Lan said, "That's where they are, the men who tried to kill Hilo. Gaunt is there as well, and Ike too, perhaps." The realization hit her squarely. They were leaving to do battle. Shay gripped her brother by the arm.
"What can I do to help?"
Lan looked at her, and she realized how ridiculous her question was. She couldn't help. Not in this, not now, not jadeless as she was.
"Nothing," Lan said. "Don't let Doru take over the clan, if he was killed."
"I found out more," she said, almost desperate to delay his departure. "At the treasury. I didn't want to say anything in the room with Doru there, but I need to talk to you." "When I get back." He gave her a quick kiss on the forehead.
"Why didn't you phone me last night?"
"There was no need. You don't have to be a part of this," he said. "I promised not to pull you in any further beyond what I've asked of you so far, which I know is already more than you wanted." He looked over her shoulder, and his face tightened. Shay turned. Kaal Sen stood on the stairs like a baleful mummy, wearing a white robe that hung off his scrawny frame. His fierce gaze roamed the assembled fighters, and alighted with blistering disdain on Hilo. He pointed at his youngest grandson, leaning into the gesture as if his bony finger were a weapon.
"Your fault," the old man snapped. "What have you done now? You were always nothing but an impulsive hooligan. You're going to ruin this family."
"Granda," Lan said warningly. Hilo stepped forward through his pack of warriors.
"They tried to kill me, Granda."
His voice was soft, but Shay knew that Hilo spoke softly when he was most angry.
"They nearly killed one of my fists. It's war now." "Ike would not go to war with me."
Kaal Sen's arms shook as he gripped the banister.
"We were like brothers. We had our differences, but war between green bones. No, never. If anyone tried to kill you, you deserved it."
Hilo's eyes flashed fire and hurt. Then he turned away, scorn flowing from him like a cape. "Let's go." His fighters flanked him as he stalked through the door and out of the house. They piled into the line of cars parked in the roundabout. Kaal Sen sagged and sat down on the stairs, his limbs folding like a rickety chair frame, his robe draping over his bony shoulders and knees like a sheet. "Kianla," Lan called. "Help Granda back to his room." He put a hand on Shay's back and said in a low voice,
"Stay with him."
Shay nodded, trying to think of something more to say, such as "be careful," or "good luck," or "please come back." But none of them seemed to be right, and Lan was already leaving, going down the steps of the front walk, climbing into an open car door that one of the clan's fists held open for him. Chapter 20. Clean Blades at the Factory. The factory was an old manufacturing facility just across the territorial border in the mountain-controlled Spearpoint District. The building still read Kaycon Special Textile Company in large faded paint on the outside wall, but it had been converted years ago into a gathering place and training hall for mountain greenbones. According to the No Peak Fingers and Lantern Men who'd called in overnight and early this morning, the two surviving assassins, Gom Oben and Chan Dal, had been seen fleeing the armpit on foot and coming here. They arrived in a convoy just before noon, six cars packed with No Peak fighters. They parked in front of the factory and piled out in a storm of slamming doors and glinting weapons. Lan and Hilo stood together at the front, conferring. The brick building was tall and the windows were covered, It was impossible to tell how many Mountain Green Bones were waiting inside. Hilo pointed out the sentries watching them from the roof. So far, no one had come out of the building.
"Send in a message," Lan said.
Hilo motioned forward one of the fingers, a young man with hair hanging longer on one side and two jade piercings in his lower lip. The fighter dropped to his knees and touched his head to the ground.
"I am ready to die for the clan, Call Gents."
Hilo gave him his instructions, and the finger was sent, unarmed, up to the front door of the factory. The demand was simple. Hand over the heads of the two men responsible for the attack on Hilo and cede control of the armpit district, or no peak would come down from the forest. Coming down from the forest was an old greenbone phrase that meant open war. All of the mountain's territory, people, and businesses would be fair game. The calls watched as the messenger was met by two guards. Words were exchanged, and the man was admitted into the building. Hilo sat down on the hood of the Duchess to wait. Lan leaned against the door of his Rowulf roadster and watched the front of the building with taut nerves and a parched feeling in his mouth. It was one of those days when the sun and cloud grappled with each other in the sky, and the waiting men were bathed in alternating patches of heat and shadow, as if the weather itself was unsure of how the day would proceed. Since the moment Mrs. Sugo had interrupted him in the Lilac Divine the night before, it was as if he'd been swept along by a tsunami. He felt as if he had little control over its direction, and was battling merely to ride near the surface of it. Lan did not want a clan war. It would be bad for everyone, for Greenbones, for business, for the people, for the country itself. All this time, he'd believed that so long as he treaded carefully, he could avoid outright conflict with the mountain. He'd ignored Ait's disrespect, politely rejected her forceful overtures to form an alliance, and taken reasonable steps to secure the KJA and safeguard his own clan's position. Now he saw his actions were the defensive maneuverings of a dumb bull being set upon by a leopard. They had only emboldened the enemy, sent the impression that the Pillar of No Peak was soft, not someone to be feared. He'd been a fool. He'd known that the mountain wanted Hilo out of the way, but he hadn't anticipated that the enemy pillar would act so quickly and with such violence. Was it because his rival was a woman that he'd assumed she would hesitate to shed blood first? If so, it had been a near-fatal oversight on his part. Now Ait had whispered the name of the second son of No Peak. No matter any other business or territorial considerations between the clans, that was not something that could be negotiated away. The Call family name could not command any authority or respect unless it answered such an offense unequivocally. A mile-long freight train passed a short distance away, blaring its approach and rumbling on and on over the rails, hauling goods from across the island into the port stations in Summer Park and the docks. A breeze skimmed westward off the water. Half an hour passed. The factory remained silent and inscrutable. The No Peak men grumbled and paced and smoked. Mate Ken came up.
"They're not answering. They've probably killed him by now."
Mike's face was creased with impatience and murderous drive.
"What are we going to do if they don't answer?"
Hilo said, "We're going to storm the fucking place and drag Gonash out by his tiny balls." This satisfied his lieutenant, who grunted in agreement, but it worked Hilo up further. He jumped off the hood of the Duchess and prowled halfway to the entrance of the factory.
"You see this, Gaunt?" he shouted.
He spread his arms wide and turned in an arrogant circle.
"I'm still alive! Don't send your puppies to kill me! Come out and do it yourself, you dog-fucking coward!"
Behind him, the fists roared their assent and pounded on the cars. At that moment, An understanding struck Lan clearly and heavily. The mountain had sent men to kill Hilo, not him. Not Lan, the firstborn, the pillar. It was Hilo that the enemy viewed as a threat. Hilo, who was ferocious and violent and could lead fists in war. Now he'd survived an assassination attempt and gained for it. Lan knew what that said about him in turn. He was pillar on account of birth, and Kal Sen's decree, and a face that reminded people of his father. He strived at all times to be a strong and prudent leader, to maintain peace, to respect the legacy of his grandfather. And while those things gave him respect and credibility within the clan, they did not intimidate or dissuade rivals. The enemy had struck first, not at the clan's political head, but at its top warrior, and in doing so, dispelled any doubt that the mountain intended to move in on No Peak and conquer it by force. He was, by nature, a man slow to anger, but Kal Lan's hands curled into fists, and a churning pool of shame and rage rose in him like a cloudy tide. The door of the factory opened, and three men emerged. Lan and Mate Ken walked up together to join Hilo, who stood his ground and faced the approaching men. First came the young No Peak messenger. He hurried forward and dropped to his knees once again, looking almost apologetic to still be very much alive.
Kal Jens, I regret the dogs didn't give me a chance to die for No Peak, but they sent me back out with these two.
Behind him came two mountain greenbones.
That's them, Hilo said to Lan. The limping one is Chan. The dark one's gone.
The two sides regarded each other with hesitant mutual hatred. Chan, a mid-rank finger, was injured and scared. Sweat slicked his bruised face, and he could only glance at the No Peak fighters for a few seconds before shifting his eyes. Gom was greener in both body and spirit. Jade hung around his neck, studded his nose, encircled his wrists. He looked directly at Lan and spoke first.
My pillar agrees to your demands, Gom said. She approved the attack on your horn out of a sense of great insult for his many transgressions against our clan, but realizes she may have acted in anger and haste. So, to show her willingness to negotiate, we will withdraw from the armpit except for the small section south of Patriot Street that we have always controlled.
How generous, Hilo scoffed, but that's not all we demanded.
Gom's cheek twitched, but he kept looking at Lan.
My horn offers you our lives as punishment for our failure. This one here,
he jerked his head at Chan,
isn't worthy of a warrior's end, but my clan and my honor demand that I die befitting my rank, like a proper fist of the mountain. Kal Lan Shin Wan, pillar of No Peak, I offer you a clean blade.
Lan was honestly stunned. Then his eyes narrowed. I accept. The No Peak men had gathered around to hear the conversation, and now all of them stepped back at once, clearing a large circle of space, all except Hilo. He angled his body in front of Lan and lowered his voice.
Gom deserves an execution, not a duel, the horn said. This is some kind of trick.
You'll be here watching to see if it is, Lan said.
But I don't think so.
He didn't elaborate on how he was certain this was Ait's belated way of measuring him. She already knew something of Hilo. She tried to have him killed, and failed. Now she wanted to know if Lan was as weak as she'd taken him for. The knowledge would determine her next move. It was apparently worth surrendering most of the armpit. If the pillar of No Peak backed down, he would lose face in front of the enemy and his own green bones.
A death of consequence, then, Hilo suggested. Ken and I would do it.
Lan answered him with a scalding look, and the horn fell silent. What sort of greenbone would Lan be, to send his injured younger brother to fight Gom a second time instead of answering a direct challenge himself. He understood, without a doubt, that like it or not, he was to be a wartime pillar now, and the most unwise thing he could do was to continue elevating Hilo's battle prowess over his own in front of the clan's fists and the enemy's eyes. So it had to be this way, the Greenbone way. If force was the only language Ait understood, then he would have to speak clearly. Gom retreated several paces.
Knife or blade?
It was the prerogative of the one who'd been challenged to choose the weapon. Hilo favored the Talon knife. Compact, vicious, always within reach. But Lan was not a street fighter, and the formality and elegance of the Moonblade seemed more appropriate.
Blade, he said. Hilo was still skeptical.
You expect me to honor this?
The offer of a clean blade was an ironclad pledge. The victor took the loser's life and jade without consequence. No relative or ally would seek retribution. Hilo's question was rhetorical, and Lan looked at him askance.
You're worried I might lose?
Hilo turned his chin slightly to glance at Gom. He brought his eyes back and spoke in an undertone.
He's not trivial. Neither am I.
Lan said it more sharply than he'd intended.
I have a dozen fists here who'd fight Gom in your name. You're the pillar.
If I can't do this, I can't be pillar.
Lan's reply was curt, pitched low so that only Hilo could hear, but nevertheless, he'd admitted out loud what others surely believed but left unsaid, that the son of the great Khaldu needed to prove how green he truly was. Lan drew his Da Tanori Moonblade from its sheath and held it out to his brother, who spat on the white metal for good luck, though he didn't smile.
He has good offensive deflection, Hilo said. Better to fight him from close in.
He squeezed Lan between his shoulder and neck, then retreated to stand beside Ken. A nameless pang touched Lan in the chest. He ought to say something else to Hilo, just in case, but doing so seemed as if it would be bad luck. Lan was not devoutly religious, but he sent up a silent prayer to Zhenshu the monk, the one who returned, the patron of jade warriors.
Old uncle in heaven, judge me the greener of your kin today, if it be so.
Then he turned and faced Gom, and touched the flat of his blade to his forehead in salute. The other man returned the gesture. They circled each other. The sky had abruptly cleared, and the sunlight beat stark on the pavement. The embedded stones seemed to pulse under Lan's palm, layering jade energy into him, stretching his clarity, changing the way space and time moved. Seconds lengthened, distances shortened. Gom's heartbeat throbbed in the center of his perception. He sensed the man's jade aura shifting, testing, expanding and contracting, subtly judging when and how to attack. For a terrible second, doubt rushed in. Lan had once been at the top of the academy, and won his fair share of violent contests, but it had been years since he had dueled. Gom Oban had been groomed by Gaunt Ash, and had greater and more recent experience as a fighter. Perhaps Ait was gambling intelligently. He might lose to this man, might doom his clan. Perceiving Lan's instant of uncertainty, Gom chose that moment to attack. He stepped into a classic opening high sweep cut, then changed his direction deftly and sliced low. Lan caught the misdirection in time and deflected the blade. He circled his own weapon around in an upward piercing strike. Gom twisted away, throwing his arm up against the side of his head. Lan's blade sheared against his steeled arm. Lan launched into an offensive flurry of quick cuts. Their blades sang together in a lethal duet. Blocking and deflecting, Gom gave ground, then pivoted sharply and slammed a kick into the pillar's side. Lan felt his ribs compress and heave under the man's strength. He pulled himself light and flew back, landing on his feet. The watching men hurried backward to make more space. Out of range now to reach his opponent with the blade, Lan remembered Hilo's warning, just as Gom flung his left arm forward with a shout and a heaving burst of jade energy, ripping a wave of deflection through the air strong enough to hurl a grown man to the ground. Lan rooted into a forward stance and threw up his own deflection in a vertical shield that parted the other Greenbone's attack like the prow of a boat. He felt the clash of energy reverberate through his frame, clattering his clenched teeth as he skidded backward into his planted heel. Like the suck of a receding tide, he felt Gom pull his aura in, readying another spear of deflection. Lan rushed his opponent, lightness and strength turning him into a blur of speed. His moonblade carved a deadly path toward the side of Gom's neck. The other Greenbone whirled under the slice and slammed a palm strike to Lan's sternum. All the energy the fist had gathered for the deflection, he channeled into the blow. Lan gave every fiber of his being into steel, knowing in an instant he would live or die based on whether the other man's force could break him. Everything dimmed. He felt Gom's energy batter and buckle him. It pierced his ribcage and seized his heart. Lan felt death tickle the edge of his mind. His steel splintered, but it did not break. It held in a moment of stalemate, and then it roared outward, scattering the force of the killing blow. He was, after all, a call. Gom had given all of himself to the attempt. He swayed on his feet for an instant, his jade aura wafting pale and flimsy. Lan sunk his blade into the man's side like it was a block of soft bean curd. He had almost nothing left either, but he pulled across, parting tissue and arteries. His perception clamored white as if drowning in psychic noise. The final spike of pain and fear from Gom, the backwash of energy as the man's life fled him, the multitudinous rush of triumph and elation from the watching warriors of No Peak, and then the second fist of the mountain slumped to the ground. Lan fell to his knees, gasping.
"Thank you, old Uncle Genshu, for your favor," he whispered.
Then, raising his voice so all could hear, he spoke to his opponent's body. "You carried your jade well, and you died a fist's death. You were a worthy opponent, Gom, a loss to your horn." He wiped both sides of his moonblade down the inside sleeve of his left arm, and raising it high, rose to his feet. "My blade is clean." From the sidelines, Call Hilo gave a curt nod to Make Ken. The fist stepped around Chandal, who knelt in resignation of his fate. Make pulled the man's head back and opened his throat from ear to ear with a deep, swift stroke of a talon knife, then pushed him face forward onto the asphalt.
"No Peak! No Peak!"
the Greenbones erupted in chorus.
"Call Lanjen! Our blood for the pillar!"
They dropped to their knees and beat their fists on the ground in a drumbeat of applause, their exuberant, pent-up strength denting the pavement. Lan cut off his enemy's jade chokers and bracelets and tore the studs from his face. So much jade in his hand made his throat feel dry with heat and his scalp tingle as if the roots of his hair were charged with electricity. He was moving as if in a dream, dizzy with relief. He stood.
"We're leaving," he shouted. "But let our enemies know this. No Peak defends and avenges our own. You wrong any one of us, you wrong us all. You seek to war with us, and we will return it 100-fold. No one will take from us what is ours."
Lan thrust the fistful of jade he'd won above his head, and the din increased. He saw Hilo cross his arms and rock back on his heels, smiling. The green bones piled back into the cars. Their bloodthirst, if not fully quenched, had been sated by the outcome of the duel. Lan allowed himself the grim satisfaction of seeing the clan's warriors hailing him, as he knew they hailed Hilo. To anyone watching, the fight had seemed quick and decisive. The mountain would not retaliate over the kills. No peak had not lost any lives, and the armpit was now almost entirely theirs. It was a victory, wasn't it? Lan walked past his own silver roadster and pulled open the back door of the Duchess instead. Sitting alone in the wide back seat, he let the jade he'd taken drop next to him. He unstrapped his moonblade and rested it on the floor across his feet. He ached. The jade around his arms and waist seemed unusually heavy, and he felt injured somewhere deep inside. He wondered if anyone else had noticed how close the fight had been. Hilo got into the front passenger seat. Once Mate Ken had pulled the car onto the freeway and they were speeding back through the city, Hilo twisted around and offered his brother a cigarette, then lit it for him. He turned to face the front again and rolled the window down halfway.
"Must hurt like a bitch," he said quietly. "Lie down, Lon. No one here to see but us."
Chapter 21 Family Talk. Shay sat next to her grandfather, her hand over his knobby one. After the commotion of her brother's departure, the house had fallen incongruously quiet. She wondered where Doru had gone, whether he was still in the house, or if he'd departed to make phone calls or do whatever else it was that he did. She thought about going to check, but didn't want to leave her grandfather. He seemed shrunken and frail in a way she had never seen. Underneath his liver-spotted skin, she still felt the thrum of his powerful presence, a weighty jade aura anchored by an iron will. But the way he sat now, there was a deep resignation in his slack posture, a bitter understanding that he was no longer the beating heart of the clan, no longer the torch of Kakon. Kianla brought Kaal Sen a bowl of cut-up fruit on a tray and fussed over his blanket and cushions, making him more comfortable in his chair by the window. He swatted her away and turned clear but weary eyes on Shay.
"Why don't you come live at home? What have you been doing all this time?"
Shay tensed, but her grandfather's questions were less angry than perplexed. Sad.
"You want to live in Jonlun but not with your family? Are you seeing another man? Another foreigner you don't want to bring home?"
"No, Granda," Shay said, irked now.
"Your brother needs you," he insisted. "You should help him."
"They don't need my help," Shay told him.
"What is wrong with you? You don't know who you are anymore," Kaal Sen declared. "I used to say you were my best grandson. You remember that?"
Shay did not answer him. She tried not to keep watching the front drive the way one might watch a pot of water on the stove. She realized with dull despair that she'd become what she'd sworn she'd never be. A woman like her mother, sitting at home worrying while the men went off to meet danger and mete out violence. Her younger self would be disgusted. She was a daughter of Kaal Du, a grandchild of Kaal Sen. Indeed, his favorite. Growing up, the idea of being any less than her brothers had been anathema. Somewhere at the bottom of a drawer in her childhood bedroom, there was a journal she'd kept as a teenager at the academy. If she were to set it on its spine, it would fall open to a page with a vertical line drawn down the center, dividing it into two columns. On the top of one column was her name. On the other was Hilo's. For years, she'd recorded every score and rank she'd received as an initiate. Without his knowledge, she did the same for Hilo. He was more talented in some areas, but she practiced more consistently, studied harder, wanted it more. She graduated at the top of their class, despite being the youngest in their cohort. Hilo came in sixth. She'd been a more highly ranked Greenbone than her brother, and proud of it. It had taken her a few more years to realize how little it meant. The demerits that had pulled down Hilo's scores, reprimands for skipping class, sneaking off campus, instigating street fights, had won him the admiration and following of peers. The countless hours Shay had spent alone, obsessively studying or practicing, had isolated her from the other students, especially the other women. Hilo had spent that time idling with the wide posse of friends who would become his most loyal fingers and fists. Looking back on it now, Shay could almost laugh at her teenage naivete, her hopeless earnestness, her inevitable disappointment. One day, Hilo had discovered her journal and the two-column page meticulously comparing their ranks. He'd laughed so hard, tears came to his eyes. He'd told his friends, and they'd teased her about it mercilessly. Shay had been furious and humiliated by how amused he was, how utterly nonchalant he felt about her mission to best him. Her anger only baffled and entertained him further. "What are you saving this for?" He'd waved it in front of her. "So you're better than me at school, sure. Are you planning to lord it over me 10 years from now?" He tossed it back at her, smiling, and this infuriated her further, how he didn't even bother to take it away or rip it up. "What do you need to try so hard for all the time, Shay? Lon will be pillar someday. I'll be the horn, and you'll be weatherman. Who's gonna care about our grades then?" It had almost turned out that way. Lon was pillar now. Hilo was the horn. She was the one who'd ruined the triumvirate. She was the broken piece. Hilo had been so furious when she'd left, not because he hated Aspenians, or Gerald, or even the things she'd done and the secrets she'd kept. It was her refusal to fall into proper place in his vision of the world that had enraged him. In the hotel, he claimed he'd forgiven her, but she found that difficult to believe. She tried to interest her grandfather in the bowl of fruit, but he wouldn't have it, so she ate it herself. "The war was an easier time," Kal Sen muttered all of a sudden. "The Shatarians were cruel, but we could resist them. These days, Aspenians buy everything. Our jade, our grandchildren. Greenbones fight each other in the streets like dogs." His face twisted as if in pain. "I don't want to live in this world anymore." Shay squeezed her grandfather's hand. He might be an old tyrant, but it disturbed her to hear him talk like this. She tugged on her right earlobe, remembering that Gerald had always teased her for the superstitious Kekanese habit. "Don't say that, Granda." She glanced back out the window and stood up so quickly she nearly knocked over her grandfather's tray. The gates were opening. Cars were driving through and parking in the roundabout. Shay called for Kianla and hurried down the stairs. Her brothers were walking through the front door together. Relief swept over her, weakened her knees. She put a hand on the banister to steady herself. Lon gave her a smile that looked thin around the edges. "Don't look like that. I told you we'd be back, didn't I?" Hilo said, "You missed all the fun, Shay." He threw a proud arm over Lon's shoulders and called back to his first fist. "Ken, get these guys sorted. I need some time for family talk. Don't let anyone else in." They went back into Lon's study and shut the door. "What about Granda?" Shay asked. "And Doru?" "They can wait," Lon said. Shay was astounded. To her recollection, Lon had always included Kal Sen and Doru in the clan decisions. Shutting out the patriarch and the weatherman was an affront. It sent the unmistakable message that the winds in the clan had shifted dramatically. More disturbing, she was in here. Her brothers had included her, even though she wasn't wearing jade. People might begin to think she was replacing Doru. She didn't want that at all, but she couldn't leave now. Even as she told herself she ought not to be in here, she sat down in one of the leather armchairs. Lon lowered himself gingerly into the one across from her, and she realized he was hurt. He wasn't bleeding, but he looked pale and drained, fragile in a way she'd never imagined her older brother could appear.
"Lon," she said, "you need a doctor."
"Later," he said. Shay noticed his left hand moving, rolling beads of jade in his palm. New jade, she realized. Jade he'd won.
"What happened?" she asked.
"We sent two of theirs to the grave." Hilo remained standing. He was still armed to the teeth and hadn't relaxed. "Lon took one of their best fists with a clean blade. We executed the other. The armpit's ours."
Shay said, "You're not smiling."
Walking through the door ahead of his men, Hilo had been grinning and triumphant. Alone with Lon and Shay, he wore a scowl.
"This is just the opening move," Lon said. "They'll try again."
Hilo paced a short line in front of Lon's neatly ordered bookshelves. "I'd had men ambush me last night. Gaunt sent out his fist to challenge Lon today. The mountains shown they can hit us hard at the top and not even show their faces. We might look like we're ahead for now, but they came too close. They heard us. People will talk, and it'll be bad for us."
Shay said, "You killed four of their men."
10 fists don't matter next to the pillar," Hilo said. Lon shifted his attention to Shay. He seemed to be trying to move as little as necessary.
"Tell us what you found out. From the treasury."
Involuntarily, Shay glanced around the room, almost expecting to see Doru hovering in the corner.
"I told you about the new equipment that Gaunt Ash signed for. Well, it's being put to use. Production at the mines is up 15% this year, the biggest increase in a decade," she said. "So I wondered, where is the extra jade going? I examined KJA financial statements, and there's no accounting for the increase. Foreign sales haven't increased. You told me yourself the vote to raise the export quota didn't pass. Allocation to the martial schools, temples, and licensed users is only up 6%. That leaves an awful lot of jade that's been mined but not distributed."
"So it's sitting in the vault," Hilo said.
"No, it's not," Shay said. "I went to the Kaycon Treasury and checked the last 3 years of records. There's no increase in jade inventory that matches the growth in production. Somewhere between the mines and the vault, jade is going missing."
"How is that possible?" Lon asked. "The weatherman's office audits..."
He stopped himself. His back teeth came together, flexing his jawline.
"Doru."
Hilo spat the weatherman's name. His head swung toward the closed door.
"He's in on it.
The mountain is producing extra jade and smuggling it away under our noses, hoodwinking all the other clans in the KJA and the Royal Council, too. That ballless old ferret has been covering for Ite and keeping us in the dark."
A shadow fell heavily across Lon's face.
"Doru has always been loyal to the family. He's been like an uncle to us since we were children. I can't believe he would betray us to the mountain." "It's possible he doesn't know about the discrepancies," Shay suggested. "Someone under him could be tampering with the reports that he sees."
"You believe that?" Hilo asked.
Shay hesitated to answer. As repulsive as she found Doru, she had to agree with Lon that it was difficult to imagine the veteran weatherman ever undermining the clan. When it came to war and business, her grandfather had trusted him absolutely for decades. How could the Torch himself have been such a poor judge of character?
"I don't know," Shay said, "but he has to go. If he's not a traitor, then he's a negligent weatherman."
Lon exchanged a glance with Hilo.
"We'll find out which it is. We keep this to ourselves for now."
He turned back to Shay.
"You're certain you have proof of everything you've said?"
"Yes," Shay said. "Document all of it, and send 3 copies of your findings to Woon Papi Dunwa by tomorrow. Woon and no one else.
Lan paused.
Thank you, Shay. I appreciate what you've done, finding this out for us. I hope it didn't inconvenience you too much. I'm sorry if it did.
That was it.